Now, when I guess Ute, when she saw the program, was excited to hear something about economy and me talking about economy. I'm going to disappoint you a little bit because it's not going to be about economy in that sense. When talking about time scarcity, one could think that I will have a talk about this idea of economy in a narrow sense. What I'm going to do today rather is not going to speak about migration, and it's not kind of research findings I'm going to present you. It's something I would call theoretical reflections within the realm of sociological theory, at the margins of sociological theory, maybe. And I also want to already apologize for the poor English of my presentation. Now, I start with a reading, an article I have, it's not an article, it's a protocol I've read recently. In an internal discussion with his friend and colleague Max Horkheimer in the mid-1950s, Theodor W. Adorno complained about the fact that they as a representatives of critical theory, were all too often confronted or attacked with a concept of praxis that was appropriate to a state of emergency. I quote in German, schon immer hat man uns einen Begriff von Praxis entgegengehalten, der einer Notstandssituation angemessen ist. So, practice appropriate to emergency. What would he mean with this? Let me start with an observation I have made in undergraduate classes in sociology. When in one of my introductory courses on social norms, I asked the students to form two opposing groups in order to discuss the pros and cons of civil disobedience, I was surprised to see that in those groups were supposed to support civil disobedience, the main argument was always lack of time. Whether it was the impending deportation of a refugee or the adoption of tuition fees, students argued that it was necessary to bypass legal procedures, not because the laws were unjust, but because of pressure of time. Obviously, one could say this is the same kind of argument that we observe in the, as it were, classical state of emergency debate, where evildoers of all sorts impose on us immediate responses which in turn threaten the given set of legal and social norms. But before I start discussing the relation of time and action, I also want to situate my claim in the context of critical security studies. Why consider time at all? The answer, I suppose, anticipates somewhat my main argument. My main point. An argument often brought forward in the context of criticism of security politics and technology is that security forestalls and controls behavior. In opposition to purely legal mechanisms, security aims at what not yet has happened. Its target is potential behavior. By grounding its rationale on something that empirically doesn't exist, since it's located in the future, it dissolves the normative structure of action. But at the same time, this temporal inversion seems to be what is needed for any process of emergence. Roughly spoken, the question is whether there's an alternative to the Schmittian concept of decisionism as a way to deal with the not only etymological relation between emergence and emergency. Now, this might be seen as a field for philosophy, and it is, probably, but I will argue that there is a link between the way this question is handled in current debates around capitalism and critique of capitalism, and the element of a state of emergency within that realm, and that this link is reflected in the constitution of social theory. Now, anyone who deals with the issue of time in social theory very soon realizes that starting already with Emil Durkheim and Max Weber, social scientists do not tire to emphasize the purely social essence of time. What seems to be the quantitative and therefore coercive character of time, one could argue with Norbert Elias, does not root in time being a natural phenomenon, but in the social relations people need to establish in order to cooperate and to create common rhythms of action. And only due to this, to the different rationalities of these social relations, and this is a second mainly sociological argument, we do experience different speeds of time and thus time at all. Now, as Sven, with regard to Luhmann's concept of law, has shown, the temporal structure of law is characterized as safeguarding or protecting the past against probable emerging actions in the future. Law must therefore shield its contents from actual events in order to maintain its normative structure. The very definition of law and norms is there being prescriptive. But at the same time, the feature of prescriptiveness seems to be jeopardized by non-normative social temporalities. In his post-war essay on the situation of legal studies in Europe, Carl Schmitt criticizes the increasing speed of legislation, a process he coins the motorized legislator, in which laws are being replaced by decrees. Since World War I, Schmitt argues, we can observe a structural transformation of law, representing a, I quote, mortal danger to the whole existing normativism, end of quote. While Schmitt holds legal positivism responsible for this development, I want to turn our attention to the relation of law and its environment. What was the reason why, as he writes, I quote, the pressure to adapt legal provision to rapidly changing circumstances was irresistible, end of quote. An almost standard answer, not really a standard answer, but at least within this conference, answer to this question in social science is linked to the concept of biopolitics and has been discussed in a vast area of fields, as we have seen today and yesterday already. The argument here, how I would sketch it this way, goes as follows. The increasing valorization of the social body since the 18th and 19th century created the necessity for planning as a means of securing the social environment surrounding capital, or those investments in a broader sense. With the increasing potential value attributed to life in general, a politics of life is directed towards the future, making sure that the conditions of valorization are maintained. Prevention and planning are thus essentially connected to biopolitics. And there is also a relation to the problem of what Leibniz called the sufficient reason. And what today reappears in a way in the economic term of externalities, on which then Hart and Nagy draw their theory of immaterial labor. It is precisely this sufficient reason logic that kind of enables social and political stratagems of security. It enables the inclusion of a wide array of collective subjects to participate in politics of security and make security a mechanism of creating society, of social bonds. So, according to this approach, to this Foucauldian approach, the intrusion of non-normative elements, one can thus say, starts far earlier than Schmitt assumed, and it is not caused by the shortcomings of legal studies. In this first dimension of temporality, we are dealing with the distinction between past and present, present/future, more precisely with the endangered hegemony of the past over the present. Normativism is the hegemony of past over the present. In contrast, security and biopolitics are the hegemony of the future over the present. But there is more to temporality. The intrusion of economical, social, political events and rationalities into the realm of norms casts light at the relational character of time. In contemporary critical theory, there are two standard arguments concerning time. One is related to the so-called tyranny of the clock, from Marx, Lukács, Horkheimer to Benjamin or Thompson. Quantification of time through the clock relates to the rationalization of labor under capitalism so that, as Lukács has put it critically, I quote, time is everything, man is nothing. This argument refers to the quantification of life as such, often coined as the Bergsonian critique. The second argument also refers to different temporalities or timescapes of social systems, where the economic system, as in Habermas' famous phrasing, colonizes the life world. In this second argument, the inherent opposition is not that of quantity versus quality, but that of a differential of speeds. Already Simmel had diagnosed the intrusion of market forces into society as an, I quote, extreme acceleration in the pace of life, a feverish commotion and compression of its fluctuations, in which the specific influence of money upon the course of psychological life becomes most clearly discernible, end of quote. Which leads Simmel to the conclusion that there is a power of the trend in the money economy to subject other contents of life to its own pace. A popular symbol that you all know of this critique of acceleration of the social by means of economic rationalities is the famous scene of Charlie Chaplin in Modern Times, where he's being fed by this machine. The scene incorporates this basic model of critique. One could phrase it as modernity or capitalism is too fast for humans. As one could also roughly summarize the version of how Hartmut Rosa describes the problem. The temporal colonization of the life world, the acceleration of social action, raises questions about the character of social action itself and draws a connection to the realm of the classical state of emergency problem. As in martial law, the rationality of action is contracted or compressed in two ways. First, it is contracted to one single norm, that of saving the mere existence of the acting unit. This is what Schmidt called legitimacy of action as opposed to legality. In order to protect the social body and in its mere existence, the sovereign can use any extra legal means. On the level of the social, this is the quantification, aka economization, of the heterogeneity of social life, reducing it to the single economical rule and pace. Relevant for the purpose of my presentation here is the second contraction. Actions are evacuated from reflection or reluctance. Similar to the highly accelerated condition of combat, action seems to be collapsed into a kind of stimulus-response model. In a classical and quite influential approach in sociological theory, that of George Herbert Mead, social action is defined by an element of deceleration as a moment of reflection that interrupts the chain of reactions within the stimulus-response model, and that thereby constitutes the very essence of human interaction. People don't just react, as Mead argues. Rather, there exists a moment that Mead called the specious present, during which the individual interprets the situation and considers various responses to the gestures or utterances of another person. Instead of a simple stimulus response model, SR, the SR sequence, Mead argued in favor of a stimulus interpretation response model, the SIR sequence. And he stressed that the response is something that is more or less uncertain. In order to become specifically human, action must be reflected. And reflection here includes suspension. Thus, I quote Mead, delayed reaction is necessary to intelligent conduct because it makes possible the exercise of intelligent and reflective choice in the acceptance of that one among those possible alternative responses which is to be carried into overt effect. End of quote. This formulation enabled Mead to include consciousness, choice, emergence, and novelty in this theoretical framework. Nonetheless, Mead observed that the, I quote, social nature of the present arises out of its emergence, end of quote. And if the present is characterized by emergence, then the past does not determine the future. I quote again, Mead, the present is meant with it. Its chief reference is to the emergent event, that is, to the occurrence of something which is more than the processes that have led up to it. End of quote. Now, in some way, Also Virilio in his Dromology also relates to this idea in characterizing the logic of deterrence in what he calls the War of Time. The installation of the so-called hotline between the heads of states of the US and the Soviet Union serves nothing short of, now again a quote of Virilio, the preservation of a properly human political power, since the constant progress of rapidity threatens from one day to the next to reduce the warning time for nuclear war to less than one fatal minute, thus finally abolishing the head of state's power of reflection and decision in favor of a pure and simple automation of defense systems. The evacuation of thought amounts to coercion through automation. When acting under conditions of emergency, we usually think of ourselves as not acting on our own account, but as forced to act according to what the situation itself demands. It seems that the rationality incorporated in the material and social environment commands our actions. Or to use the Weberian terminology, action turns into behavior, since the difference between action and behavior is characterized by its degree of awareness, of reflection. The German prefix Not in words such as Notwehr or Notstand indicates this subtraction of agency from the individual or subject through situation. In Virilio's scenario, the collapse of action into immediacy is precisely due to the transposition of action to machines. Just as with Schmidt's usage of the metaphor of motorization, it seems that acceleration is mediated by machines or objects. But this effect is not restricted to machines, in the classical term, understanding of machines. They rather seem to represent a specific case of contraction. Consider panic. Panic generally is conceived of as a typical case of action where cognitive operations are replaced by immediate responses to outward impulses. Panic is connected to the theme of the fear of the masses. We have heard about this yesterday, where masses, just like in the work of Le Bon or as in the work recently of Sloterdijk, are depicted as a mind and ruthless mob capable of the worst, where the bourgeois individual would backpedal, the mechanisms of reflection seem to be switched off in the masses. Up to this point, everything seems to be in accordance with the standard critique of security, the colonization of the life world, and the critique of the state of emergency. Speed is anti-human, speed is alienation. In the course of the presentation, I have indicated two ways to break up with speed and its demerits. One was reflection or thought, and the other were norms. However, from a structuralist viewpoint, this is not a very convincing description of norms. Luhmann, for instance, has argued that norms are constituted by a specific rationality, that of scarcity. Norms emerge, according to Luhmann, because we need to save time, and because we want to avoid complicated processes of deliberation at any given interaction. Without norms, and this is true for many sociologists, social action would simply become impossible. To make social action happen, norms help to reduce the complexity of the situation. And from this perspective, apparently, norms are rather accelerators of social action. What then about thought and reflection? Let's recall what Mead had suggested regarding the role of thought in social action. Without thought, Mead contends, action would simply not happen. But why is this the case? Because in Mead's understanding, action via thought only insofar constitutes time as something novel is created. Mead draws this from Whitehead's concept of the event. The mere passing through of reactions is not enough to constitute time. Suspension, one could thus argue, ultimately creates time, but only insofar as it is tantamount to becoming. One could argue now that norms, such as in the legal system, enhance and facilitate action in a very specific sense. In what sense? In the sense of a cyclical return. The subject experiences the passing of moments cyclically, just as in Hume's famous succession of A, B, A, B, A, B, etc., In this way, the subject contracts habits which make sense of time as a continually living present. Norms or habits are thus the passive synthesis of moments that create the temporality of presence. Mead's Whiteheadian argument was that action only constitutes time if something new is added to the world, thereby opening the present for the future. However, norms in themselves would not afford fortuity. Thought doesn't seem to be the solution of the problem either, because thought can also have accelerating effects. When you think of the economy of thought, a model that is applied in Luhmann's concept, or as in any utilitarian approach. What if the suspension of reflection in the various settings mentioned earlier is not entirely negating time and futurity, as we must assume with Mead? What if Mead, in his polemic against the behaviorists, overemphasized the role of the mind in the creation of the novel? Countless sociologists conceptualized the human as an entity almost completely isolated from any bodily or material dimensions. What if the element of a fuzzy determinism ascribed to Mead's theory was to be located not only in the mind, but in the body too? This is, we already heard about this here, the proposal of, to just give you one name, of the theory of Brian Massumi's theory of the effect, in which the novel and thereby time is created through the interplay of physiological processes and cognition. For Massumi, suspension and thus emergence can only be understood as an interplay of bodily and cognitive reactions to an event. Cognition itself would only reproduce structures and rules. Now, what can be drawn from this, from my initial questions, a question about the relation of emergence and emergency? From a decisionist point of view, and to some degree this applies to Luhmann's system theory as well, reflection and thought potentially lead to an endless reflexive abyss that has to be avoided at all costs. In this view, emergence is rather located in the subject's voluntarism induced by time scarcity. Theoretically, the state of emergency, in the classical sense, with its atmosphere of urgency then, would be the perfect field of emergence. This is obviously not the case, or it's not a very convincing description. It would maybe become more convincing if we would add to the state of emergency what Benjamin called the real state of emergency. On the other side, the, as it were, classical critique of capitalism's deterritorializing effects too much relies on norms as decelerators, which results in basically relying on reterritorialization as the only opposition to deterritorialization. The problem here is that speed and slowness, or deterritorialization and reterritorialization, always go hand in hand. To break out of the problems posed here, we cannot base a critical strategy on one of the two interconnected dynamics. I cannot unfold the complex relation of those two concepts here, but I want to suggest that, roughly spoken, that it is precisely this connection between the two processes that constitutes the capitalist social machine. Criticism of speed, aka deterritorialization, must rather focus on new connectives or on alternative connectives between the two, that is, on new assemblages. Thank you.